Welcome, everybody, to Assertive Engagement with Parents and Caregivers. We'll start with some introductions. My name is Julie Cohen. I am part of the implementation team here at UCLA PMHP. I am also a licensed marriage and family therapist. I have been working in community mental health, primarily with children and youth, for the past 30 years. Early in my career, I started one of the first counseling programs in the country that focused primarily on children who were exposed to domestic violence. Oddly, that's a newer concept that kids are affected. And I've spent most of my career focusing on trauma and children and women. I've also worked in DMH programs for many, many, many years. The last 10 years I spent working as a director and a supervisor in a child FSP program. So I am really familiar with all of the issues, the frustrations that go on when you are working in intensive mental health programs. So at this point, I am going to let my colleague, Danielle Farmer, introduce herself.
Thanks, Julie. Hi, everyone. Good morning. I'm Danielle Farmer. I am one of the community mental health trainers here on the team. I am a licensed clinical social worker, and my background is mostly in school-based work. And so I worked for a few years as a teacher and then also as a school social worker and school counselor. So more within the realm of the mental health field for the past about 10 years before starting this position. So lots of experience with case management tasks with children and families, engaging families into the school system, helping to build their capacity to advocate for their children and to partner with the schools. So picked up a few tips and tricks along the way. So I'm really excited to be here with you all today and just kind of share some tools with you all. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Danielle. Okay. So our first objective, this training will provide FSP team members with a foundational understanding of assertive engagement principles and strategies when working with parents and caregivers. Two, participants will learn the core concepts of assertive engagement, including active listening, empathy, and effective communication techniques. The training will focus on building rapport, establishing trust, and collaborating with parents and caregivers to support their child's progress and well-being within the FSP program. And finally, participants will learn to identify common barriers such as resistance or cultural differences and develop strategies to engage parents and caregivers in the FSP program effectively. So what is assertive engagement? Assertive engagement is an array of techniques to proactively engage difficult to engage participants, including one, individualized and varied strategies, two, motivational and collaborative interventions, and three, positive incentives. Now, assertive engagement is a term that comes from the evidence-based practice assertive community treatment, or ACT, and some of you may have heard of this. FSP and FSP transformation is actually based on the ACT model. In traditional therapy, when a client doesn't show up for a session, what does a therapist think about the client? Maybe that they're being difficult, that they're not ready for therapy. And if you can throw out there the number one phrase that therapists always use about clients who are not doing it the way they should be doing it in therapy, they are just waiting to see if anybody wants to throw it in the chat. Not ready, yes. But there is a term that is like the most popular of all that therapists love to non-compliant. That's a good one. Resistant. Those are all good. Resistant. That is the one I was thinking about. Therapists are notorious, and I am one, so I can say this. And I have done this. They're being resistant, and the meaning that therapists take from that is that it's time to stop trying to engage, right? A client must meet the therapist where the therapist is to prove they are ready for the work. And if they can't, the therapist moves on, right? Assertive engagement turns this assumption around. In fact, it throws those assumptions away and works from a strength-based and unconditional positive regard approach. Outcome measures from the ACT model show that when a team makes extra efforts to engage, there's higher client retention and success. So this is a shift in mindset, right? That the onus is on us to work harder than the client to engage with them. If at first we don't succeed, try again. And then try and try again. And then try and try again, and so on and so on. Now, of course, there's limits to what we can do, but think of this more as like a mandate, as a mind shift, right? So why do we need to use assertive engagement? Building therapeutic relationships with clients and their families is much more complicated in intensive mental health programs. This is because you're dealing with clients and sometimes their caregivers who have untreated mental illness and other disorders. So assertive engagement involves the use of interpersonal skills and inventiveness to engage clients and interest them in subsequent care. It entails taking multidisciplinary services directly to the people. If assertive engagement is for clients, why do we need to use it with parents and caregivers? Well, because when you are working with children and adolescents, as many of you know, you don't just have one client, do you? You have multiple clients. You have two or more, sometimes three, four, or five, depending on your client's support system. So if you don't develop and maintain a solid connection with the parents, with the caregivers, treatment will be limited at best and sometimes won't happen. Assertive engagement fosters team building and a belief that every voice matters. So how do we do this, right? So I've outlined here seven activities, and these are going to look kind of familiar to you. So even though we're like teaching you maybe new lingo on this, you know, one of the things that's important is that you start identifying, oh, we are actually doing a lot of this already, right? So let's look at these. Active outreach, meaning that teams go the extra mile, or, and you all know this saying, do whatever it takes, right, to initiate contact and establish a connection. We do this through various means, including home visits, schools, and community settings. Collaborative relationship building. Our number one priority is to create a safe and supportive environment where children and families feel comfortable sharing. This is done through active listening, empathy, and by respecting the family's perspective, their culture, and their values. Individualized care planning. No cookie cutter or cut and paste treatment plans are ever used or should ever be used in FSP. Teams work closely with the child and their family to assess their specific needs, strengths, and challenges. Together, they develop a comprehensive care plan. Timely access to services. Families are given access to appropriate services when needed. Supportive interventions. Families can access evidence-based therapies, skill-building programs, psychoeducation, crisis intervention, and other specialized services. Multidisciplinary team approach. This may include clinicians, case managers, psychiatrists, psychologists, educators, and other relevant professionals collaborating and working from one treatment plan. And so this brings up the idea of using a one-stop shop approach when able, and ideally in FSP, we want to have as many services under one roof as possible. And I know that you all know that's a very tall order, that we can't always have all services, and especially with children and teens, right? Because, you know, we can't really like bring the school into our agency. So there's going to be times that we can't do this. And just with budgets and staff shortages and all of that, it's really difficult to have a one-stop shop. So this is sort of an ideal where we have as many of these services as possible under one roof. And when not, extending that collaborative approach to outside service providers, right? So we just, if we can't just, if we need a bigger team, we're going to bring people in from the outside. And finally, ongoing support and follow-up. After the initial engagement, teams maintain regular contact with the child and their family, providing continuous support and monitoring progress. This happens through regular check-ins, including home visits, therapy sessions, and child and family team meetings. So communication style is key with parents and caregivers. A core component of assertive engagement is strength-based communication. So if you look at the bubbles here, in the center bubble is what is important to parents during engagement. If you're working with adults only, this bubble changes to what is important to clients during engagement. So it's really parents and clients because you have both, but I want to use this interchangeably. But when your first meeting is usually with the parents, right? Your first contact is with the parents. So it's really important to start off right away with a strength-based approach. Acknowledge their expertise. And one of the things that I always do working with parents is I'll say, you know, you're the expert. I see your kid 1 hour, 2 hours a week, and you're with them. You've been there with them from day one. So it's not my job to kind of tell you what to do here. In fact, I want you need to be an integral part of this team because without you, we're not going to get anywhere. So we really want to establish that the parent, you know, is the expert and that there is this client parent directed treatment. Now, we always talk about client directed treatment, even with kids, and that's true. But again, remember when you're dealing with children and adolescents, you have to pull the lens back a bit and you have to include that parent, you know, and you can bring them in by saying things like, you know, what are your hopes for your child in treatment? Like start to develop what they want to happen. And also unconditional positive support. And I think underneath the idea of unconditional positive support is the idea that we believe in our families, we believe in the parents, we believe, you know, in the capacity of the kids, of the parents together. And no matter what they tell us, we're not going to respond in a judgmental way, right? We're going to go with using strength-based interventions. And finally, literally meeting them where they are at. Now, and we all know this is where field-based services comes in. So on a physical level, we're going to go where they are, but also on an emotional level, we're going to meet them also where they are, right? And we're not going to try and tell them what to do or don't. We're just going to meet them where they are. And likewise, opposites, these are communication styles that we want to avoid. And because, you know, research has shown that actually when we are working from a strength-based approach, there is more success, better outcomes, more client retention. So if you go in the opposite direction and we try to lecture them, and you know, our clients and our families are not easy. FSP is the hardest program or one of the hardest programs you can be working in. And so you're constantly, I think, being pulled in a way of thinking, oh man, like just like every nerve is being touched. And you know, whereas in your everyday life with friends or family, you may turn to one of these styles. When we're working in FSP and with our parents, we really have to stay with that strength-based approach. I'll just point to one of these in here where it says praising Only the results and not the effort, right? I really like that one in particular because, every step that somebody takes along the way towards the end goal should be recognized. All right, so I have given you sort of a brief intro overview to what assertive engagement is about. So I have two examples up on the screen. One of them is an example of assertive engagement. And so I would like you, I'm going to read these and then feel free in the chat or to unmute yourself. And we'll spend a couple minutes talking about which one you think is an assertive engagement example and which one isn't and why. So team number one, we met with mom several times and discussed our services. We were very clear about how we thought we could help our son. We listened to her and reflected back what changes she wanted to see in her goals. Both the son and mom seemed interested. However, follow-ups were difficult. Mom did not return my calls or answer the door when I arrived. We tried, but ultimately this was a voluntary program and we did our best. We referred the case back to DMH. Right, so that's team number one. Team number two, after our initial meeting, I tried calling mom several times about starting services, but she never answered or returned my calls. After trying a few times, I asked another team member to try engaging with mom, and she seemed a little more receptive to him. They had a very short interaction at first. However, she invited him to the house, and he's returned several times. He mainly plays games with her son and asks her if there's anything important for him to have in his life. She finally mentioned that having a working internet and a laptop would help her son with his schoolwork. So go ahead, feel free again to unmute yourself or put it in the chat. Which one is an example of assertive engagement and why? And what differences do you see between team number one and team number two? Absolutely. I think that's really important that, when you said sort of, I think, decentralized or, that it wasn't just about one person, that you're working as a team, right? So I'm seeing a lot of good, let me just scrolling back here. Team two, I feel, is more assertive, using other resources to gain contact with the family. Absolutely. Team two, more attempts at connecting with the family and meeting them where they're at. Absolutely. Reaching out to another team member to assist in engagement. Team two, option two, took extra approach for engagement. Client and solution focused. Absolutely. A continuation of engaging client and having different team members engage with the family. The assertiveness was needed in attempts to build rapport. Absolutely. Team one could make sense in a more outpatient clinical setting, but with something like FSP, seems more could have been done. Absolutely. Staff starts where the client is at and establishes rapport. 100%. So absolutely, you all really have this down. And I think, again, I don't think a lot of this is super new working in FSP. But certainly, this should give you some validation if this is how you're working, that you are really showing fidelity to the model of FSP. So when we talk about FSP transformation, so really, really good stuff. And the thing that I really liked about what you're saying is a lot of you focused on the sort of shared caseload team building approach, that you taking this to the team and figuring out how to work together. And that is so integral to assertive engagement and also just successful client outcomes. All right, so I'm going to show you just a little snippet to kind of bring all this together of this. And the link to this is in the handouts in the slides. So it's like a 5-minute video, but we don't really have time to show the whole thing today, so feel free to watch it later. But we're just going to show like just the first almost couple minutes.
Imagine if somebody designed a family home but completely ignored the needs and the realities and the preferences of the family that would occupy that dwelling. A cliff-style location with stark beauty, just right for a house full of toddlers. Beautiful, wide-open, loft-style bedrooms with ladders and circular staircases for grandma and grandpa. A wonderful pergola, but no place to put cars, garbage cans, bikes, or toboggans. It would be disaster. There was a time when mental health services for children and youth and their families were a bit like that. It was all about the expertise of the practitioner. The practitioner as expert, and the child as a recipient of service. It was pretty much a closed loop. But we were missing the boat because we didn't recognize the untapped potential of family involvement and engagement. We've come a very long way. Today, we see very clearly what families bring to the design of practice for children and youth. Contemporary practice embraces the notion of family engagement as a fundamental value. And that young person is still the primary focus of the treatment. However, when the family is a partner in the process, the family, the circle of care and support, becomes an essential part of the experience. It begins with adopting a family-centered approach.
Okay. Again, I recommend you guys watch the rest of this after the training. And I'm going to turn this over now to my colleague, Danielle.
Thanks, Julie. So when we think about assertive engagement, there are kind of three general areas that make up the things that guide us through the process. So the first one is mindset. So this refers to the way we think about the people that we work with, maybe the beliefs that we hold about their abilities, strengths, motivations. This is kind of our mindset and how we prepare ourselves and our mentality to address their needs. And so when we think about what kind of mindset assertive engagement calls for, like Julie said, it's that strength-based, individualized approach and really just unconditionally believing in our client's ability to make change. The next one is skill set. So this refers to how we go about doing our work. So that technical knowledge, the skills, the tips and tricks that we've picked up, whether it's through formal training, informal channels like other colleagues, maybe supervision, or just general work culture and how, you know, our organization does things. These are the ways that we can get the skills for how to do the work. And so an example on the slide is, you know, motivational interviewing, right? Those are the skills, or solution-focused interviewing, the ways that we're using those tools to the individual need of our client. And so assertive engagement, again, should always be individualized, right? So not using the tools that we've learned in a blanket kind of one size fits all way, but instead using it in a way that feels relevant and important for our client. And then the final one is heart set. So this is how we feel about the people that we work with, which really translates into how we treat them, right? So it calls us to reflect on, if are we valuing their opinions? Are we honoring their right to self-determination, even if we don't agree, right? Sometimes with their decisions or their opinions, recognizing if there are any biases or judgments that we might have. And I think this last one is equally, or if not doubly important when we're working with caregivers and parents, because there's kind of a dual space that we can use to judge our clients, right? We can evaluate them and judge them as a person, but then also evaluate and judge them as a parent or as a caregiver, right? So there's that double space to look out for in the way that we feel about those clients. So what differentiates assertive engagement from, you know, rapport building, from the things that you're already doing to build relationships with your clients? So when we think about the actual definition, rapport building refers to establishing a positive and trusting relationship between the team member and the client. It involves creating a comfortable and supportive environment where clients feel safe to open up and share their thoughts and emotions and experiences. And the goal of it is to establish a strong therapeutic alliance, right? So that's really the foundation of effective therapy. So when you have that solid rapport between the therapist and the client, it enhances communication, it encourages active participation, and really increases the likelihood of positive outcomes. So rapport building really refers to these one-on-one strategies you generally use, you know, in general in your practice for clients to get to know them, to build that trust. So that could look like, you know, specific questions that you're asking during intake and during the first couple sessions to start building that engagement. It could be the facial expressions or the tones that you use to convey warmth or empathy, the communication techniques that you use to keep in touch with your clients, or how you keep track of important details about them. So the rapport building are the things that the client sees, right? So when we think about maybe like an iceberg, right? Rapport building is that tip. That's what the client see. That's the what they feel the impact of. That's what they can recognize. Okay, they're making an effort to engage with me, or they're not. You know, I'm not seeing these things. But assertive engagement, it really refers to the more internal process. So maybe kind of that underbelly of the iceberg. So that's how you're preparing yourself and your team to go above and beyond when maybe sometimes certain generalized strategies aren't enough, right? So it could look like being creative in how you're gathering information, using different communication strategies when maybe your calls and texts aren't going through or being responded to. So like we've seen in the example, right? Going above and beyond just the standard level of care and really using that team approach. So having kind of a shared caseload model to engage the family. You know, it's about putting yourself aside and using techniques that you know work for the client, no matter whether that's you or whether that's someone else on your team. So there are a few key elements of rapport building. The first one being, and again, as Julie stated, these are things that we know you are already using. So hopefully this just kind of validates that you're already implementing principles of assertive engagement. So the first one being empathy, right? So just understanding and accepting their feelings, their thoughts, their experiences, and their perception of the world, right? And using your actions to show that you understand that and you have compassion for it. Active listening. So just being fully present, as you know, as hard as that can be, especially in times where we're sitting with strong experiences of trauma, right? Or fear or hurt or really uncomfortable feelings. Active listening really conveys to the client that you care about what they have to say. They're valued. What they are experiencing or sharing is important. And just demonstrating that genuine interest in what they have to say so that they feel like they're not just another face or just another check mark on your to-do list for that day, but that, you know, they're actually a priority for you. Trust and confidentiality, which is really key, especially in kind of higher needs families. So maintaining that confidence, creating that safe space for them without judgment or fear, respect and validation. Collaboration and shared decision-making, right? So working together as a team and collaborating to make decisions about the direction of treatment for the client or about setting goals together for the client, making sure that voice is really carried throughout the steps of treatment. Clear communication. So this one I think is really important too for us to remember, because sometimes we are so used to using jargon or clinical language with our colleagues or in our notes, right? And so sometimes that spills over into the way that we communicate things with parents. And I think for those of us that are used to working with children, this might be a little bit easier, right? Because we're already so used to changing language to match maybe developmentally where one of our clients is at. So I do think you probably all are more skilled at this maybe than the average worker. But just really using understandable language for the client, avoiding that jargon, avoiding technical terms that might confuse them or make them feel more isolated or kind of distance yourself from the caregiver or from the parent, just really making sure you're using language that's understandable. And then obviously this happens usually in the beginning of treatment, but again, these can happen throughout every step of the process. So places assertive engagement happen. So really assertive engagement can happen anywhere you're conducting tasks related to the family's care. So whether that's, I think when we think of the home, that's obviously the first place we think of when, like Julie said, quite literally meeting the family where they're at, right? The home is the best place to do that. And it makes engagement as easy as possible. But next are some of these more external systems, right? So general engagement strategies kind of call for us to understand the systems that our clients are involved in. So we may engage in a few case management tasks when necessary, but sometimes work can be kind of isolated in our own domain. But assertive engagement calls for us to actively build those relationships with those systems and those key players. And this is great because it can kind of serve multiple purposes, right? These key players can become sources of information so that we can better understand the family. They can become advocates for us while we're still building that trust. So I think this is really, really key if we have providers that have already been working with the family for years. When we build strong relationships and those key players trust us, they can vouch for us with the family, and that can go a really long way. They can engage in families with families, like I said, that we might not have been able to do yet. So they can give us pointers. when we engage with these outside systems, we can then fully get a picture of what the family is already receiving, right? What services have they already gotten? What's been available to them already? What have they not utilized yet? It's better to get a fuller picture when we use these kind of strategies. And then finally, when we know and have built relationships with all of these systems, then we can start advocating, right? We can start seeing maybe some of the gaps or some of the complaints or concerns that the family has, and we can advocate on their behalf. So when we think about key players and systems like DCFS, like they're, you know, a social worker or attorney or a CASA related to DCFS, in the school system, people like admin, teachers, counselors, maybe the juvenile justice system, or just in general, other natural community supports that are super important to the family, like coaches or advocates or other agencies they may be involved in. When we think about settings like IEP meetings, these are really, really rich opportunities for information. In these meetings, you'll get updates about the functioning of a child, the involvement of a caregiver, the services already being either given to the child or recommended for the child. And these are great places to ask questions and advocate too. So IEP meetings, and schools love acronyms, right? So there's lots of different meetings that you may encounter: an IEP meeting, an SST meeting, SSPT meeting, a care team meeting. There's all kinds of meetings. Nobody loves meetings as much as service providers and educators, but they're each an opportunity to bring people together around a table to talk about a family. So these are great places for you to advocate, to be involved in if the family consents or if you're able to. And then again, just like school-based meetings, child and family team meetings are also great settings to practice assertive engagement and to have that kind of input. So I believe Julie will cover that next.
So child and family team meetings, anybody here not familiar? I mean, anybody in an FSP program working with children or young adults should be familiar with it at this point. But if you're not, just quickly, a child and family team meeting is a strength-based meeting that brings together a client's family, natural supports, and formal resources. And, you know, what do all CFTMs have in common? Well, they're all strength-based. They're client-directed, and they provide unconditional positive support. So are you noticing a theme today, right? That these are key things that need to be included in assertive engagement. Outcomes in CFTMs, collaborative decision-making has been shown to increase client success in treatment. So why is it an important part of assertive engagement? Child and young adult programs have something that other programs don't, which is a built-in structure for assertive engagement. And it's really, a wonderful place where you have regularly scheduled monthly meetings that creates consistency and builds trust between family and team members. So you have this, you know, a pre-scheduled meeting depending on how you do your CFTs, but these opportunities for just regular occurring times when everybody gets together to check on goals, see how things are going. And I know that having to hold regular CFTs, I was in FSP for, you know, almost 10 years, and sometimes it does feel like a pain in the butt to do them, but the reality is that they are, in my opinion, really a gift, especially in regards to assertive engagement. Definitely an opportunity to work smarter and not harder. Happens to also be required. And so really a rich opportunity. So let's shift gears now and look at some of the barriers and challenges that you might encounter. I'd like you to take a look at this diagram that you see in red and blue, right? The blues are the client barriers and challenges, things that they bring in. The reds are the things that we bring in, that we bring to the table. These are our barriers. And, there are times, you know, where our clients come in with all sorts of barriers and struggles and challenges. And sometimes we do everything that we can do, but we still can't get sort of past that challenge. And we can feel really stuck, and we can feel almost sometimes like we're failing this child, or, we can get very frustrated with it. But I think it's really important to kind of take a step back and realize that there's only so many things we can control for. So, for instance, a client and their family can come in with their own history of trauma, substance abuse, their own mental health history, and they might be in different places of where they are with these things. They might have previous system involvement, and so here we are as FSP, another system, and they may come in with preconceived notions of how this is going to be based on their own personal experiences. Our clients may have learning challenges, medical issues. Parents might have medical issues. And of course, there might be cultural issues, and also just sort of various other things that are, that don't fit into one of these other categories. And so all we can do really, and this is where going back to sort of that bubble slide, is sort of meeting the clients where they are. That's our job. Our job isn't to fix all of these things, right? And we have to be able to stay freed up enough to kind of control what we can control and support the client and the families in their process. So for instance, if we look at some of the red areas, some of the things we can look at as a team are like staff turnover. I don't know one agency that's not dealing with staff turnover. And so for instance, working from a shared caseload perspective, which is, comes out of FSP transformation, means that everybody knows every client and every role, right? So if a therapist leaves or a case manager leaves, it feels burdensome. I don't want to make it sound like a panacea, but at least it feels like somebody else on the team or other people on the team can sort of pick up the baton while you hire. So the idea of how, looking at shared caseload, lack of training. So meaning like when we talk about it's sort of engagement and it's sort of that try again approach, it's like that's actually a skill set. It's not just like, oh yeah, we're gonna try again. It's like there are a lot of techniques and skills that your experiences have taught you of how to do that. And so how is the rest of the team? Do they get that? Do they understand it? Do they need some mentoring, some training in that? And the last thing, meeting inconsistently. This again, in FSP transformation, the gold standard of meeting, and again, this isn't something you have to go and do, is meeting every day, is having a team meeting, a short team meeting every single day. And that has shown, again, to increase client retention, client success, and staff retention. So anyway, just throwing these things out there is that sometimes when we can't control all of these outside factors, we can kind of look inward at ourselves, at our own teams and programs, and look there. So here's some global barriers to treatment. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. These are, I think that these are fairly familiar to all of you. I don't think I'm, reinventing the wheel here, explaining to them. And they are more global. You're going to see them with adults. You're going to see them with children and youth. And what I want to focus on today, child and youth assertive engagement barriers, right? So, but I did put a link. Sorry, I did put a link on here to our adult assertive engagement training, which will go more into this area. So feel free, that training just happened, so it will it was recorded and it will pop up on this link within the next week or two. Okay. So the remainder of our training, we're really going to start looking at some of these more FSP child youth specific barriers and challenges that come up that can get in the way with our connections with parents. And I am going to send this over to Danielle.
All right. So DCFS reporting and just the process of suspecting child abuse or neglect and having to go through with the report really can be one of the biggest threats to building that trust in the rapport with the family. And it's really, you know, one of the hardest parts of our job. And so, you know, we can't change the law. We can't change our role as mandated reporters, but we can try and take steps to preserve the relationship with the family as much as possible if we're put in that position. So the first one, understanding the protocols at your agency around child abuse reporting, or if there aren't any, advocating that there are, you know, clear protocols. And I think one thing that helps when you have very clear understanding of what are the policies, what are the steps that I have to take in my agency if I have to make a report, can really help you feel more confident in your ability to handle it and be able to communicate with a family in the event that it has to take place. So for example, understanding, you know, your agency's policy around who calls, right? Who do you need to inform ahead of time or afterwards if you do have to make a report? You know, if you're in a situation where you're in the middle of a session and you have to make a report, do you stop after the session? Do you do it during the session, right? Who is supervising the child? You know, who are we informing the parent? Are we not? Those are all things that can be agency specific and even, you know, situationally specific. So those are things that's really important to understand ahead of time. The next thing is partnering with colleagues to ensure client safety. So again, assertive engagement really is a group effort. So utilizing your supervisor or colleagues and even people who have the, you know, the strongest relationship with the client, you know, in the event you have to debrief with a family or in the event you have to have a difficult conversation or you have to separate the client and the parent while you wait for DCFS to come, really utilizing those key players to help support around that. Discuss limits to confidentiality during intake and review them regularly. So this one is a super important step to help kind of set you up for success and try and prevent some of that, the fallout that can happen after a DCFS report. And so sometimes reporting child abuse can be so difficult because for the family, it can feel like, you know, a judgment on their parenting, but it can also feel like a betrayal, right? When it comes from a relationship that they have put trust in or built rapport in. So you want to do what you can to make sure that they're not feeling caught off guard. So when you're doing intake with a family, you always, and a lot of this is already in your paperwork, so you're naturally going over it, but you want to review limits to confidentiality. So just, and again, putting that in layman's terms, right? So saying what we talk about will stay between us unless, you know, I'm concerned about the safety of the child, right? So if they plan to harm themselves, if someone is harming them, or they plan to harm someone else, right? So putting it in very clear terms and being explicit about what that means, right? For them, even within our field, there's lots of discrepancy on what constitutes abuse between counties, between states, right? There's lots of different room for interpretation or subjective understanding of what abuse could mean. And so we don't want to put our parents in a position just to have a gotcha moment, right? So we want to give them our purpose is to build their capacity and to help them. And so we want to give them that understanding of what it is ahead of time. So saying, I have to report instances of abuse. Abuse looks like A, B, and C, right? Being very explicit about what it is that you have to report. And then reviewing these regularly. So for example, especially when, if you're meeting in an office, especially with younger kids, I had a big sign in my office and I would review it, you know, almost every session, especially in the beginning, saying, remember, you know, what we talk about stays in here unless, you know, ABC. So reviewing that with a client, reviewing that with a parent, that way it's always top of mind that it's a trusted and special relationship, but if I'm worried about safety, then I do have to involve other parties. And then using clinical judgment when deciding on if you're going to inform the caregiver and the client or not that you made a report. So different agencies have different policies. You know, some agencies require that you always tell the parent before or after a report is made. Some agencies say, you know, don't tell the parent unless you want to. Yeah, every agency is kind of different so that, you know, there's no gold standard for that. You know, ideally, of course, we want to build capacity in any way we can. So if we feel like we're using our clinical judgment and weighing the risk to the safety of our staff or ourselves or the child, if we do disclose that we were the ones that made a report, when we weigh that against the capacity to help the client grow and process the rapport in the situation. You know, we have to see what has the most benefit and what has the most risk. So really just using our own clinical judgment for that to determine what the best step is. But sometimes we don't always have the choice, right? Sometimes there might be situations where a parent knows that we made the report because we were the only one who knew about a situation, right? Or the child only told us about something, so they know it came from us. Or sometimes caseworkers might accidentally say, oh, the call came from the school or from this organization. So sometimes we don't always have that choice. So again, just really planning for repair in the event that, you know, this situation happens. And so we can do all the things, all the best practices, and the client will most likely still be upset, and that's okay, right? Our job is not to convince them not to be mad at us, because it's an understandably troubling situation for anyone to be in. And so our job is to hear them out, right? If whether they know where the report came from or not, we can allow them that space to process and validate their feelings, maybe not validate their actions, right? But validate their feelings about the situation. Then using restorative practices, you know, to explore what happened, make a plan for how to rebuild that trust if possible. And then again, utilizing our colleagues. Sometimes it's really helpful to have another staff member step in to facilitate this kind of conversation and help repair that relationship. But it is really difficult. And so making sure that you're taking care of yourself too in these stressful situations. So really similarly to DCFS, when we think about managing mental health crises situations, so whether that's a hospitalization or having to restrain a client, we follow really similar patterns and really similar principles. So some parents and caregivers can often be caught off guard with these kind of situations, right? Because we're having to make more restrictive decisions regarding their children, which can be really uncomfortable. And we're oftentimes forced to make decisions based on maybe a legal or ethical mandate that we have for our role that differ from what the parent wants us to do or what they feel comfortable with. And so, you know, sometimes our hands can be tied. And so again, like with child abuse reporting, we can still try and take steps to preserve that relationship. So again, the first two principles are really similar to DCFS reporting, understanding the protocols for your agency around crisis management. So, you know, different agencies have different protocols of if you're initiating a hold or a hospitalization, at what point do you call the caregiver? Do you call before? Do you call after? What if you can't get a hold of anyone, right? What if the parent asks you personally to transport the child to the hospital? What are your regulations around that? What are your policies around that? Again, that can really help you to feel more confident if you're put in a position where a family is asking you to do something that you may or may not feel comfortable with. And then again, discussing those limits to confidentiality, just like with child abuse reporting, making sure that you're frequently reviewing the fact that you have to involve other individuals or other agencies if you're worried about the safety of a child. Familiarizing yourself with assessment tools. So, you know, what are you using to measure suicidal ideation or homicidal ideation? What are your markers for low, medium, and high risk? You know, because every tool could be different, every agency can be different. So really understanding what your agency specifically uses and who your partnering agencies are, right? So what phone number you need to call for transportation, what hospital you go to. These are especially important if you're new, right? So you don't want a crisis situation to be the first time that you get these numbers. You want to have them ahead of time so that you can make quick decisions that you feel comfortable with. The last one is caregiver communication. And so some of the biggest barriers when we're working with families is, like we mentioned before, having that dual responsibility to the client and to the caregiver, which sometimes feels like they could be at odds with each other. So I've done a lot of risk assessments in my day, and I feel like it's rare that a child is excited for me to call the parent about it, right? Often they are saying, you know, I don't want you to call my mom. Don't want you to call my grandma. Please don't tell my aunt that, you know, I'm having these thoughts or that this situation is happening, which can be hard for us, right? We want to honor their voice. We want to honor what they're saying. And of course, if there's child abuse concerns, then of course, you know, then that's a different route. Then we want to make sure that we're listening to safety concerns that might be coming up around disclosing. But if it's safe to do so, you know, legally, so a lot of times we have to inform the caregiver, which can be really difficult. And a way to preserve their relationship with the caregiver, right? Because if we don't tell them, that could also be a breach in rapport. So steps you can take is just being very clear with the child about what you're going to tell the parent. I think a lot of times children have misconceptions of if the clinician is telling the caregiver that I'm, having suicidal ideation or anything like that, that means they're going to tell them every single thing I've ever revealed to them in treatment, right? So being very clear of here's what I need to disclose, here's what I don't, here's what the conversation with your caregiver will look like. And if depending on the age or developmental level of the child, having that conversation together, right, so that they know what you're disclosing to the caregiver, they are able to disclose what they feel comfortable disclosing, and also the caregiver can hear it from the child's voice, so that you're still again trying to honor that relationship with both of them. Keeping in mind ethical and legal mandates, like we said, there's a lot of times where parents or caregivers may not agree. So you want to honor them as much as you can under the constraints of what you're ethically and legally mandated to do in the time of a crisis. Psychoeducation is one that's huge in these kind of crisis situations, just like you would give education on what's going on for the child, for the client in these kind of situations, you might have to do that same thing with the family. So again, explaining what's going on, explaining what ideation means, explaining what self-harm is, or, you know, whatever the situation is, in non-judgmental and layman terms, right? Helping, and part of that could be helping coach them through the feelings that can come up, because that's incredibly scary for any caregiver to hear that these things are going on with their child, whether they expect it or not, right? So helping them, coaching them through and helping giving them coping skills too. Having your rationale prepared for the steps that you're taking and making sure that we're always acting out of a space of clinical judgment and not acting out of a space of just trying to ease our discomfort or our anxiety. So having that rationale, whether it means we need to step away and write it down really quickly, or, you know, think through and process the situation with a colleague before we make the final call or the final decision for hospitalization, is going to be really key. Not only because it just makes your life easier later for, you know, things like process notes and paperwork, but it also just helps when you're communicating to the caregiver of explaining maybe why you had to initiate a hold or why you had to hospitalize. So just, you know, preparing you for those conversations. And then the last part is just preparing caregivers for all the possible outcomes. There can be situations where we may tell the caregiver that we're starting an assessment, but they may not understand that that could eventually result in a hospitalization, right? So it really comes down to that piece of informed consent, or informed as much as getting as much consent as we possibly can. So informing them of all the possible outcomes of what we're doing so that they're not caught off guard when a hospitalization occurs and they didn't know that that was even a possibility. So really just preparing them and getting that information to them as much as you can. So that is it for this slide. I'll pass it back on over to Julie.
Thanks, Danielle. Splitting. That is a word that is thrown around quite a bit in the therapy community. It really is a term that comes out of psychotherapy, and it's a defense mechanism. It's some people use it to cope with emotions, thoughts, and conflicts. It involves viewing the world and oneself in extreme all or nothing terms, often dividing people, experiences, or feelings into sharply polarized categories of good or bad with no middle ground. So someone is either all good or they're all bad. Splitting occurs in triangulation, or three people, where two people are against one person. Okay, there may be other ways to design splitting situations, but generally it's this triangle. So it could be, for instance, parent A aligns with parent B against the child, or the child and parent A align against parent B. In some of my favorite situations, the child and one or both of the parents aligns against me or the therapist or one of the team members. I think that's probably a fairly familiar scenario for most of you here. So a child's perspective, splitting involves extreme views of the parents. So when it's sort of one parent is good, one parent is bad. So mom is always loving, caring, and perfect in every way. Dad is always strict, angry, and never understands me. Or I can't trust my parents. They never support me, which might be, a child trying to split the therapist with the parents. Mom is my savior and dad is the villain. Mom can do no wrong and dad can do no right. Examples of splitting between a parent and a child against the team. Child's perspective might be the team is the savior. The child might view the team as the only person or people who can truly understand them and can help them with all their problems. They see the team as the perfect, caring, and supportive place and people who will make everything better. You may start that way, but on the other hand, the child might suddenly shift their perception of the team and they see them as the enemy. The shift could happen if the team challenges the child's beliefs or suggests changes in behavior or thinking patterns. The child may perceive the therapist as controlling, not understanding their true needs, or conspiring with the parent to make them miserable, right? So a parent can join this in several ways. They can support the child's idealization. The parent might encourage the child's positive view of the team if they believe that the therapy is helping the child and they trust the team's judgment. They could also blame the team. If the child becomes too resistant to therapy or expresses negative feelings about the team, the parent might align with the child and blame the team for difficulties that arise. They may view the team as causing distress in the child or not being competent enough to handle the situation. A parent can begin to feel undermined. If the child starts to trust and rely more on the team, the parent might feel threatened or undermined. They may fear losing their control or influence over the child's thoughts or behaviors. So I'm just curious if any of you are familiar, have experienced this in your work. Okay, so I'm getting some yeses. Yeah, I think this is a very, very common situation. Okay, so how do you manage all the time? All the time. That sounds like someone who works in FSP. All right. So how do you manage splitting behaviors? And it goes back to, I'm just gonna, I feel like it's on a loop a little bit, but it's really through strength-based communication. So that's just, I'm just gonna, like, I can wear that on my forehead today, strength-based communication. I think that splitting is really, really tough. It's really, really tough on the team. And it's kind of like you have to dig your heels in the sand a bit to prepare yourself to, like, don't take this personally. Don't take this personally. And you kind of have to do this mental mind movement to get yourself out of, like you want to just kind of deck them, or if you want to say something you might regret. And you kind of have to really center yourself. Like, this is not about me. This is not about me. This is about, and reach for that sort of, that find the empathy of, like, how the family may be feeling. Like, they may be very scared. Splitting often comes from fear. And so you have to start identifying with what are those underlying feelings. And again, you do that through a strength-based approach. The first thing you do after you dig your heels in the sand and you do that mind shift, you might want to, have a family meeting, right? You might want to call all parties together, get them all in the room together, right? And provide, I'm going to just repeat myself today, but meet them where they are, whatever the feelings are, and provide unconditional support. Now that is, I know, a tall order. When someone is like, you're the worst people I've ever met. I've had 14 other FSP teams and I've never experienced this, and that's hard. It's hard. And you have to kind of be able to shift And kind of hold that discomfort, hold their discomfort and go, wow, you are really, really upset with this situation. Tell me more about what happened and what, you know, and really, you know, there's a need, I think, in, you know, I think it's instinctual. We want to pull away from that. We don't want to we don't want to kind of walk into the fire. It's counterintuitive. But that's actually what we need to do. Because I think what's happening here is somebody's not feeling heard. It doesn't mean you're not trying to listen to them or hear them, but they're not feeling heard and they're feeling devalued and invisible. And you want to make them seen, right? And oftentimes, if you let somebody go through their feelings, go through their experience, tell their story, you'll start to see them soften. Especially if you are just providing, wow, okay, this happened. You're validating the story, you're validating the feelings, and you'll notice that shift when somebody feels heard, right? And you know, the other number one thing, and you all know this, I'm gonna say it again because sometimes we really want to, is never take sides. Never go, yeah, you know, your husband is kind of a jerk. You know, you never want to, or yeah, you know, our case manager, you know, she's brand new, she doesn't know anything. Because that's just completely feeding into it and missing the point of somebody feeling scared, somebody feeling invisible, somebody feeling devalued, right? And that's where you want to stay. You want to hold your position, dig your heels in the sand, don't take a side, and walk into the fire, right? Do the thing that feels counterintuitive sometimes to do. You know, I think some of the goal in those conversations is to end with a discussion where you bring people back into the fold by saying, you know, again, what changes would you like to see to get us back on track with treatment? Right. Mike, you know, and that's sort of my language and a little therapisty, but you can do it in any language you want. And you want to present that question to anybody and everybody in the family. Right. You can even present it to team members. Right. Again, it's about sort of negotiating, getting everybody heard and everyone on the same page. Okay. All right. Divorce or parent discord. So many of our families are dealing with divorce or parents fighting, being very much in opposite places. And I have to say that, you know, again, one of the reasons that many people are apprehensive to working with children is because you have to work with their families too, right? And so these are really tough situations. You know, and FSP in general is so tough, and divorce parent discord makes a complicated situation even more complicated, right? So these are a couple tips that I would tell you. Be neutral and committed. So kind of what I was just saying with splitting is be supportive and don't take sides with anyone. You know, you're going to have two parents coming at you with two different stories. Oh, they did this and they did that. And, you know, mom is this or dad is this. And that's why the kid is like this, right? You're going to get these. And while you're not going to agree with them, you've got to be neutral again, unconditional positive support. Wow, you know, you're really frustrated here. This has been ongoing. You're kind of at your wit's end. You are exhausted. You're, you know, and again, you're not taking sides, but you are validating their experience and trying to bring the level of heat down, right? Because you have to keep in mind, again, if you lose the support of one or more caregivers, you will lose your progress in treatment and sometimes treatment itself, right? So the first thing that I do when I get a family like this that is going through or has a divorce is read the custody agreement because that is where you'll find the truth and the story about what is allowed and what is not allowed with this family. You will find out who you should be meeting with and why. So, you know, oftentimes, and this is where the invisible parent comes in, is that you get a referral, single parent family, dad's out of the picture. You never even think about, like, do we get consent from dad? We don't, and sometimes I know I've learned the hard way that you walk and you start these contracts or the consents, and you start doing therapy, and somewhere along the line, somebody goes, gosh, I wonder where dad is, I wonder where the other parent is. And you're kind of like already in it. And then you realize, oh my goodness, this kid has visitate, goes to dad or the other parent on the weekends. So clearly, and gosh, I wonder what the custody agreement says, right? And suddenly you find out that there can be no medical decisions without both parents' consent, right? And so you have to, then you're sort of swimming backwards trying to figure it out. So this idea, I've run into this so many times where the emphasis is like in the crisis of the moment, dealing with the mom, dealing with the kids. That's usually how it is. Sometimes it's dealing with the dad, dealing with the kids. Usually it's the mom. And then just like dad is kind of an afterthought, or the other parent is an afterthought. And that is a critical mistake when you're dealing with families and you're dealing with children. So you really have to do your groundwork at the beginning, right? So you're asking, there may be reasons that mom doesn't want the other parent or dad or the primary parent doesn't want the other parent involved, but it may not be legally possible to do that. And it might not be clinically realistic or good, the child may need that relationship with the other parent, or, you don't know what that story is. So it's really, really important to, kind of look at all three of these points when you're dealing with a family that has marital discord or divorce. All right, so interpersonal or domestic violence. So domestic violence can become a significant barrier to providing assertive engagement in families due to many factors. I'm not going to do a workshop today on domestic violence. This is something, if you haven't already done one or more trainings, I would highly recommend it. But I feel a lot of you are dealing with these situations and have done that already. But I want to kind of make these connections to assertive engagement, right? So this barriers, the number one challenge is safety concerns. When there's ongoing violence or the potential for violence, assertive engagement may be challenging due to the fears of exacerbating the situation or putting individuals at risk. So number one priority is to deal with safety concerns. Also the power imbalance, the abusive partner may exert control over the victim's decisions and actions, making it difficult for the victim to engage with the team or make independent choices. Victims may also fear retaliation for participating in services. And we all know that oftentimes domestic violence victims are isolated from their friends, their families, their support system, and dependent on the perpetrator for everything. So it's very scary to engage in treatment for their child. And again, just along that same lines, because of the isolation and the dependency, there's often very little resources and options for them. And finally, child welfare concerns. The parent or might be really, really terrified of us making a report and having her kids taken away, because they live in the truth of what's going on in the house, and in their minds, they're not doing anything about it, and they fear maybe losing their kids. So this is a very, very complicated, difficult challenge when it comes to engagement and treatment. All right. So family and personal secrets. You know, this comes up when a family member is sort of holding on to a secret that can impact the family relationships and treatment. So it could be a secret they're holding from us, or it could be a secret that they're holding from the other family members, like, I've just spent our family fortune, I'm having an affair. You know, it could be, you know, there's, you know, substance abuse issues, sexual orientation issues, trauma histories. So that, you know, and sometimes what happens is that a family member might want to entangle the rest of the team in the secret by saying, I'm going to tell you something about Johnny, my son, but you can't bring it up, right? How many of you have been in that situation, right? Very detrimental to therapy. So one of the things that I do is I create a no secrets policy. I do this at the beginning of treatment where I say, look, we're working as a family here. This is Johnny's, he's the client here. And so I can't keep any secrets from him. So I want you to know, if you ever tell me something and then say, don't tell him, I'm not going to be able to do that. So make these rules really clear at the onset of therapy. The second thing is, have a discussion at the onset of treatment about what information you will be sharing with the parents about the child. So the child, and this usually is more applicable with teenagers, that they're going to be afraid, like, you're going to tell my parents everything, right? And that, you know, there is that sort of trust issue that comes up. And I think and we have to be very clear about defining as a team, like, what we're going to share with the parents. Like, you know, if you are a danger to self or others, if you're doing, you know, drugs or alcohol to an extent that I feel that you're in danger here, that there's a safety issue, I am going to break confidential. I'm going to tell them. And you get this agreement with all parties. So when the parents may call you and say, what did he say in session today? I'm pretty sure he's using drugs, you know, or something, that you can go, remember when we talked about this, right? I want to bring you back to our original agreement that you also agreed to. Let's clarify, you know, I would always make, like, if a parent calls and says, I want to talk to you, and that's fine, but you have to make that meeting public, meaning that you need to tell the kid that, you know, your mom wants to meet with me, I'm going to be meeting with her. I just want to let you know that. Do you have any concerns? Is there anything you don't want me to talk about? You know, what can I talk about? So again, they can happen, the meetings can happen, but your client knows about them. And again, so this will help setting boundaries. Even if a parent doesn't like your answer, they'll respect it because you have set the boundaries and the rules in advance.
All right. So another barrier that can come up is an idea of intergenerational or historical trauma. I won't get too deeply into it, but we do have a training on it that's on our website. Julie is one of the amazing facilitators of that. So I'm going to put that in the chat if you want to check that out. But really, just when we think about this with assertive engagement, it's really important to remember that parents exist as more than just or caregivers exist as more than just a caregiver, right? They're whole individuals with trauma and experiences and things that they're bringing in to shape how they view the world and sometimes how they view mental health services and you as a provider, which can be great or can be a barrier. And so intergenerational trauma happens when caregivers transfer their trauma onto the children within their care. So the children begin to experience those effects, even though they weren't directly exposed to the trauma. And so this can happen through lots of things like coping strategies that the child learns that the caregiver developed because of the trauma or family dynamics. It could also be historical trauma when it kind of trickles down through multiple generations. And so when we think about the ways, you know, historically that vulnerable populations have maybe experienced governmental institutions like healthcare or mental health, it's not far-fetched to assume that maybe the clients that we're working with, because a lot of them belong to more vulnerable communities, have experienced trauma as a result of the systems that we might be working for. And so it's important to acknowledge that, right, and always come out with a spirit of curiosity and humility to find out what's going on for the parent and ask questions to understand their perspective and not rush to, say, oh, I'm not one of those providers, or that's not me, or that's not our organization, but slowly showing through your actions and through that trust that that's not something that they have to worry about, or making sure that your organization is in the place where that's not something that they have to worry about. But definitely check out that training for more details about that. Another barrier can be how parents perceive treatment and some of the misconceptions they may have. And so Fix My Child, right, is a really common one where, whether it's parents or referring parties believe that, have this kind of magic wand thinking, right, that once they refer to FSP or intensive case management, all problems will be solved. And so really having those conversations to manage their expectations, because you will get a spectrum of engagement, right? There could be families who see your program as a relief where, okay, now they're getting all these intensive services. I don't need to, to do anything anymore, or vice versa. Right now they want to be involved in every single process. So just making sure you're being individual for, for each family's needs and setting clear expectations. Because a lot of the information is coming from lots of different places, right? The referring party, previous experience or cultural views. So just making sure that you are, if there's a discrepancy between how they view treatment and how you view treatment, going back to the drawing board, sitting down, having those clear expectations and clear guidelines so that you can get on the same page and kind of have these shared goals and shared expectations.
We are running out of time, and I'm very conscious of that. So I just want to quickly address the slide. So our last slide is lack of availability of the parents. And this is basically really being sensitive and have empathy for the fact that parents or a parent may have struggles of why they aren't available or miss their child's sessions or cancel or no-shows, right? And so if you can imagine that a single parent might be working multiple jobs, have caring for multiple children and maybe their parents, or even has their own medical issues. I know I've had parents that have had cancer and are managing on their own. And so got to be really flexible and compassionate when working and try to redirect your frustration that maybe that our program is not their, not that it's not important, but it's not their priority. So keep that in mind. So finally, I want to share this video. It's a very quick one about this woman who has gone through the system and become very successful. And I would like you to look for moments, just jot them down. You can put them in the chat, moments that you notice of assertive engagement, sort of using everything we talked about today.
I have often referred to myself as a product of the system. At a very young age, I started receiving services. In second grade, I started receiving therapy. When you talk about high risk, at-risk youth, youth that probably aren't going to make it, I was that young person. It saddens me to say that it took me almost losing my life, well, taking my life, to receive the services that I needed. I finally got a social worker that listened and that really heard me and didn't take my father's word over mine and put me, advocated for me to be taken away permanently, and I became ward of the state. I'm from New York, and I went to a residential, and I know there's a lot of controversy over residentials, and my residential saved my life. And for the first time in my life, I got to be a kid. I graduated in 1999, and we often talk about transition. Transition's always a huge piece of conversation. And I didn't have transition when I left my placement, which was the biggest downfall of that and the lack of education. I went into college, and at the time I had severe social anxiety disorder. I was withdrawn in 2001 and found myself shortly after becoming homeless at the age of 20. And there's nothing more traumatizing. Well, there are things more traumatizing, but for me at this point, to have gone so far and to fall back so far, it was really detrimental for me. And I wound up in a homeless shelter where I was the youngest person by 18 years, and everyone else there was addicted to some hardcore drugs. In that time, I got linked with an amazing therapist, and through that, an intensive case. Like, oh, you know, it's not horrible. If you don't like it, just call my cell and I'll pick you up. And I'm like, I go. And for the first time in a very long time, I met other young people that had been through similar situations as me. And even if they hadn't been through the exact same situation, we shared common feelings of lost loneliness, feeling like you don't belong. And I found home, so to speak, again. And through that, I started advocating for young people. And then I started doing it more on a community basis and then more on a state level. And then one day I got a call from a Marlene Matarese, who ironically is now my supervisor, and asked me if I was interested in doing, if I was interested in advocating for youth on a national level. And I said yes, and hence Youth Move National was born. Professionals have a certain level of expertise, but the youth and the families that live through these times have I have 27 years of experience. And I use it to further all of our cause. Because often we have the adults saying, well, we want this, but we can't find the youth, and our youth just aren't interested. It's if you ask them, they'll speak, and they'll come up with some sweet ideas, and they do provide a very refreshing and invigorating look to things that are currently going on.
Okay, this is probably a pretty powerful clip that we have there. I mean, to me, the value was really showing like what we do, what all of you do in little tiny ways of doing assertive engagement and how impactful it is. Even though it's hard, how impactful it is. So I'm gonna say thank you to everybody, and I wanna thank my colleague Danielle Farmer, who is amazing. And thank all of you.